Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very happy to be for the first time in this institute. I'm going to talk to you about black holes, white holes, evaporation. This is a work which was carried on in Marseille in a CPT with Carlo Rovelli, notably, and that will constitute the main topic of my PhD that I will defend next year. So, first, let me introduce to you the main characters of the story. And first, white holes. So white holes are perfectly valid solutions of Einstein equation, but they were kind of considered as weird, maybe on the same ground as black holes before. Are they really correct astrophysical object or not? We had to wait until the 60s before some people here, for instance, Novikov and Niemann, start giving some more dignity to this object and consider them as valid astrophysical object. So what is a white hole? A white hole is, to make it short, the time reversal symmetric of a black hole. So in other words, it is an anti-trapped region. In the Kruskal diagram, you have a white hole, which corresponds to this region where we have a singularity in the past. So anti-trapped regions mean that if I am in a white hole, then I have no choice, but at some point I will be kicked out of the white hole. And if I'm outside the white hole and I want to enter it, then I will not. That's not possible, because the white hole will be in my past. So actually we are seeing white holes almost every day, or let's say analog representations of white holes in hydrodynamics. When I'm opening the tap, then I can see down in the sink hydraulic jump, and this hydraulic jump corresponds to a region which is anti-trapped, in the sense that if I'm creating a wave outside, it will never be able to reach inside the hydraulic jump region. And if I'm creating a perturbation inside, it will necessarily go out. But astrophysically, of course, white holes are a bit more complex. And I will not go much into observational aspect. How can we really observe them? For sure, they do not look like this. This was the first page of The New Scientist a few months ago, and they represented white holes as just white holes. So this is not the thing. What one thing I could say, and that one should keep in mind, is that white holes are attractive. So even though it's anti-trapped regions, if it exists as an astrophysical object, it is still attractive. But these white holes were forgotten. And the reason why they were forgotten is because black holes are unstable. So at the beginning, maybe people did not believe in black holes, but they start believing in it when they realized that could be relevant object, and they believed in black holes even more when they have observed them. But for white holes, it has been shown, even at the beginning of the 70s, that white holes are actually unstable. And this instability can be well understood. If I take an astrophysical white hole, like this one, so here I have a shell of matter which is going out. Now imagine that I create a very small, very tiny perturbation, but very far in my past. It can be very tiny if you sufficiently find my past by propagating it. When it will reach the matter which just goes out of the white hole, it will cause the white hole to recollapse into a black hole. And this is what's shown there. If here I have a perturbation, and depending on the how strong my perturbation is, once it's gonna reach the shell that goes out, it will make it recollapse to a black hole. So people stopped considering white hole very seriously. But a few years ago, they were revived. We were revived in a new scenario, which is called the black to white hole scenario. Actually, the first motivations of the black to white hole scenario goes back to the late 70s with Frolov and Wilkowinski, what they have shown was that starting with an effective Lagrangian for the gravitational field, there might be this possibility that a shell of matter that collapsing could then avoid the singularity and goes back to and goes back in the other direction. And so that would indeed be a modelization for a black hole and then a white hole region, which is shown on this diagram. And then there were more recent motivations for this scenario. One motivation at the beginning of the millennium with Ajit Chek and Kiefer, what they have tried to do was to build some toy model for quantizing gravity and considering the collapse of a shell of matter. And in this scenario, they were seeing indeed that the singularity was avoided and a white hole could emerge. And more recently even, we have this work by Olmedo, Saini Singh, Ashtekar. By using non-perturbative quantization of the Schwarzschild just inside the black hole, they have shown that it was possible to have an evolution from a black to a white hole. The difference is that here in this scenario, they are considering eternal black and white hole, and they consider a transition through the interior. In the work before, they were considering collapsing shell, so it's a bit different. So the framework in which I've been working recently was set up in 2014 with a paper by Halagard and Carlo Rovelli, in which they were building a new metric for the scenario, which is depicted by this Penrose diagram. So what we show, what we see on the Penrose diagram is there are several regions. Here, the first region is just Minkowski. And here we have this thick line represents the shell of matter, which is collapsing. So inside the shell of matter, we have Minkowski metric. And outside, in the pink region, we have Schwarzschild. So the shell collapses, and when it reaches the singularity, then it bounces out. The framework is perfectly symmetric with respect to this line, time symmetric. Okay, so that was the scenario, which was also which had also other names like fireworks or Planck stars. And it appeared to be a nice playground to apply full covariant loop quantum gravity. Because loop quantum gravity has been developed since now many years. And it is a challenge for us to be able to apply it to a real and plausible framework and try then to extract some information and potentially observable tests. And that was one of the goals of this study. So if we have this scenario, a natural question that we want to ask to a quantum theory is, can you tell me what is the lifetime of a black hole before it decays to a white hole? So we can first do just some dimensional guess. And one guess was telling us, well, probably the lifetime of a black hole should be proportional to m squared. So here I'm working only with Planck units. So m squared, is it big or is it small? I don't know. Let's compare it to something else. Let's compare it to Hawking evaporation time. And Hawking evaporation time is m cubed, which is much bigger. So if this dimensional guess is right, then what we should expect is that if we start with a macroscopic black hole, it should not have enough time to evaporate. It should first turn into a white hole. So this transition, black to white hole, should happen to macroscopic object. So that was a guess. And then come the computation. The computation was made mainly by these two former PhD students, Marios Christodoulou and Fabio D'Ambrosio. And it took them quite a long time to be able to do the computation completely. And what the conclusion showed was not really in agreement with the guess. We had a transition time which was more m times exponential of m squared. that was not going in the direction we would have liked to. Because this means this is much bigger than Hawking evaporation. So that would mean that first, the black hole would evaporate and shrink to small size, and maybe when it's very small, there would be some chance for the transition to a white hole to happen. Another way to state the same result is to say that the probability of transition goes as the exponential of minus m squared. So indeed, if the black hole shrinks with evaporation, if the mass goes to zero, then the probability goes to one. So this framework had to be rethought by introducing in it the Hawking evaporation effect contribution. So now let's talk about Hawking evaporation. There are several ways to compute Hawking evaporation and to see how it contributes. One way is the following. So we start with a model, which is represented by this Penrose diagram. So we have just a collapsing shell of matter, which is forming a black hole of mass m. And then what we can do is to compute the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. This was done in the 70s, and here are the formulas for this specific model. So, well, in region one, the expectation value of the stress energy tensor is just zero. These formulas are valid for the Schwarzschild region of mass m. Okay. Let me precise one thing. How does this expectation value really relate to Hawking quanta? It relates this way. In the expectation value, we have actually two terms. One will correspond to the vacuum polarization of my metric, and the other one is really what we usually call Hawking quanta. So there are two contributions that, and both should be taken into account if we want to modelize correctly Hawking evaporation. Because now this is our goal. Our goal is to include Hawking evaporation in the metric. Here, in the metric, in this model, there is no Hawking evaporation. It's just only classical geometry. But by doing semi-classical computation, we see that the expectation value of the stress energy tensor is not zero. So it should be, we should modify this metric so that it includes this back reaction from both the vacuum polarization and the Hawking quanta. This is the procedure which was proposed first by Muller, the beginning of the 60s. It's based on this semi-classical Einstein equations, and it proposes an iterative method to guess a good solution to this equation. So we can start with a purely classical metric and then compute the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. And then we want to guess a new metric which will be better, and then we inject it in the computation of Jamie New, then compute again the stress energy tensor, and then re-inject it. It's an iterative method, and we hope that this method can converge and converge to a good solution of the semi-classical Einstein equations.
How do you choose the state?
Say again, the state?
Yeah, so what is the equation that controls the choice?
So the states, which are chosen here to do this computation, corresponds to vacuum on a newly infinity. This, well, here we have two different states, for instance. In this state corresponds to a vacuum in region one, and this state, which is called Boulware state, corresponds to vacuum on a null infinity. So there are different choices which are possible.
The dual evolution depends very radically on that, right? It's easy to choose states which are single.
Yeah.
The horizon.
Yeah.
So what's the, what physical principle do we use?
I mean,
this is an infinite dimensional space of
yeah.
ambiguity.
Yeah, so, well, yeah, there are several choices to choose the vacuum. Those are considered as natural one. I don't know how much that would change the formulas if we are taking other vacuum states. But probably it would, to some extent.
Well, it does, like the book we're working on is singular and
horizontal. Yeah.
So there's other states which are not, so
yeah.
They're drastically changing.
Yeah, that's true. But that would not change much for the modelization that we want to do now, because actually, whatever the state you take, even with the sums, the choice of states that we have, this equation is almost unsolvable. The iterative procedure that was proposed by Muller to solve it is already horribly difficult at the first step. So even with the most simple state that we have found for psi, it's becoming very difficult. So now how do we... Okay, so now the idea, which was an idea original by Hiscock at the beginning of the 80s, since this equation is horribly difficult to solve, at least maybe we can guess. We can guess a better metric than this one that will include Hawking evaporation. And this is the guess of Hiscock. So what is this metric? Well, here we also have Minkowski, here Schwarzschild. And what changes are those two regions, which are rainbow regions. So here, the colors indicate the value of the mass, of the local Schwarzschild mass. Everywhere in each patch, the metric can be written in those coordinates, which are characterized by a mass, mu. And to make it more visual, we have represented the value of the mass with a color. So when it's red, we have a big mass, m. And when then it goes progressively to blue, and the mass goes to zero. So from an observer which will be on Scry plus, indeed what this is the evaporation of the black hole. First the black hole is big, and then it starts to lose some mass. And this curve, we can choose for this curve, the curve which would go as the standard curve for the Hawking evaporation, so which would go as time to the 1/3. This is the beginning, and then at the end we have to change this. What we see here is that we still have an event horizon, but more importantly we have an apparent horizon, which is this boundary between region 3 and 4. And so this marks the difference between the trapped region and the region outside the black hole. So this was done at the beginning of the 80s, and we've started from this model to propose a new model for the black to white hole, taking into account the evaporation. And this is it. It's looking like that. Now I'm going to comment on several aspects of this Penrose diagram. Yes?
Can you start, is there still a singularity?
Yes, there is still a singularity.
There's
in
one in Hiscock's metric and there's one in Newton's.
Sorry?
There is still a singularity.
Yeah, there is still a singularity. But it is believed that this singularity can be smoothed out. Just to put it practically, that will horribly complicate the expression of the metric I'm just going to give now. Okay. So first of all, this is a Penrose diagram. But this is not a handy Penrose diagram that one draws on a blackboard without any justification. It's really a Penrose diagram in the sense that for each patch, we have a metric, and then we have a map from the metric to the graphical representation of the Penrose diagram, rigorously defined. So first point I want to make is that we have a mathematically well-defined Penrose diagram. The metric in each patch is given there. I will not go into much details. That means that in each patch, we have a different form for the metric. And then what we have to check is that all those patches, they can be glued together along the boundaries correctly. They have to respect some gluing conditions. And I think that's already one first point which is important to make, because somehow if we want to discuss some questions like evaporation of black holes, it is important to have models correctly defined to talk about this. Sometimes when we are just drawing a random Penrose diagram without a proper model behind it, we may be led to some paradoxes which may not appear if we have a proper model to talk about this. So that's the first point. Then let's talk about the singularity here. What's happening at the singularity? What's happening is that we can cross the singularity. More precisely, the Hawking quanta, which are here in region 3, going in that direction, the Hawking quanta can cross the singularity. How? Well, it was repeatedly noticed since actually a long time ago, in the 50s, already Singe had noticed that it is possible to glue several black hole Kruskal diagrams on top one on another in a consistent manner. There is a natural prescription to extend Kruskal diagram in this sense. So it's not, I mean, when we say that the Kruskal diagram is the maximal extension possible for the Schwarzschild metric, this is true in some mathematical sense. And in this sense, there is the idea that the space-time should be built on a manifold. But if we allow the space-time to be almost a manifold, but not completely, we allow to have points which are not differentiable, like the singularity, we get what mathematically is called a variety, and it's still possible to evolve Einstein equations on this geometrical structure. And there is a natural prescription for the geodesics that goes through the singularity. And this prescription is just to say, well, if I have a particle which cross the singularity, it's just going to keep its momentum and its energy and angular momentum. So nothing surprising there. And more recently, in the work by Ashtekar, Olmedo, and Singh, where they are doing quantization of the interior of Schwarzschild black hole, they smooth out the singularity. There is no more singularity. It kind of would be singularity. But also in this framework, we see this tells us also how the geodesics go through this would be singularity. So we have a natural prescription for this. And this is what you're seeing here. The color does not change when I go in the ingoing direction, which is another way to say that the Hawking quanta goes straight in the same direction. So we have crossed the singularity. What's happening next? What's happening next is that here I have my bouncing shell. Because first I had a shell of matter which was collapsing, and then it bounces and goes out. So I have a bouncing shell, and I have some Hawking quanta which are crossing the singularity, and they arrive on the singular on the bouncing shell. What's happening next? Do they cross? If they cross, what's happened? There should be an interaction between the bouncing shell and the Hawking quanta. So what is the best choice to make? Well, there has been works by Tuft and Rey which tell us precisely how it is possible for two null shells to cross. And in fact, there is a very simple condition to glue four patches of Schwarzschild metric. And this is the condition. If you satisfy this condition for the mass, for the various masses of the four patches of Schwarzschild, then you have a consistently well-defined metric. So here, this line would be the bouncing shell, and this would be one Hawking quantum. But we have many Hawking quantum. So we have to reproduce this several times. And this is what is done there in a discretized setting. So here we have the singularity, and we have the bouncing shell here, and 1, 2, 3, 4 quanta. And those quanta, they cross the bouncing shell. We know what are the masses before that we are expecting. Here, the mass is decreasing, goes to red, big mass, to blue, small mass. In this direction, it's decreasing. And what we want to compute is the value of the masses on the other side of the shell. And to compute this, we have this formula. And the prescription, we have no choice for the masses. Because, for instance, if you start looking at these four patches, then we have the mass here, here, and here. From this formula, we deduce the mass of mu 0,1. And then we go on iteratively, and we can progressively deduce the masses of...
How do you fix R0?
Here, 0?
R0.
R0?
You can deduce the mass if you know R0.
No, in the formula, in the equation.
Ah, so R0 is the radius which is there.
How do you fix it?
At the beginning...
The force mass, only if you know R0. It's a function of R0.
Yeah. So you need a modelization of how the radius goes inside the white hole here, how it grows. Yeah, that's true.
So what?
So we don't have to fix it to show what we want to show now. But if you know it, indeed, if you know how the radius grows here, then you can deduce the mass. Yeah?
If you look just at the point where the singularity is
here?
Why do you get to pick 0,0?
Here? So here before we have 0, because that's inside the shell which is collapsing.
Okay, and it's, right. And why do you get to pick it out?
So this is the most reasonable thing we have thought about. When the shell is bouncing in the other direction, then outside the shell it should be 0 as well.
No moving quanta isn't right there yet.
So that's the shell.
Yeah, the shell is here. And then it's bouncing.
And is the geometry around that point
here?
Smooth?
No, here it's not smooth. Here we have the singularity. So here it's not smooth at all.
But how bad is it?
How bad
is it? Is it house dwarf?
What do you mean?
Is it a manifold?
No, it's not a manifold. It's variety. So here it's not, all along the singularity, it's not differentiable. I don't know how we could characterize it, but.
If it's about the small stuff, if the bounce happens before the singularity is reached, how this picture, all this picture will be shifted?
If the bounce happens?
You assume here that the bounce happens at the singularity, right?
Yeah, it has to happen at the singularity.
Usually, in fact, even the toy model of Ashley and Co, it does happen, the singularity happens when it's one third of the power of the mass.
No, if here you have a null shell of matter which is collapsing, then it will have to end at this point precisely. Maybe you are asking me, what if I don't have a null shell, but a time-like shell of matter which is collapsing? What if I have astrophysical star which is collapsing? Then indeed, the end point of the shell will not be here, but will be somewhere else on the singularity.
No, I think Daniel is asking, the regularization of the singularity, when you regularize it, the spatial value of the quantum metric, the thickness of the quantum region is determined by the cubic root of n.
Yeah.
So that indicates in which you smooth out the singularity.
I think it would just be somehow like.
We've not smoothed out the singularity. Yeah.
No, I think the question, tell me if this is your question, is there's the shell coming in, there's the singularity. The shell meets the singularity exactly at r equals 0. But it might have started a little bit later, and then it would hit the singularity at a different r.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of fine tuning of the diagram. It seems that.
But this only happens if we don't have a true singularity, if the singularity is smoothed out.
No, I'm not asking the case that the singularity is smoothed out. In the case you're presenting, there's a symmetry around the singularity. It's not an exact symmetry, but there is the symmetry which is generated by the fact that the shell intersects the singularity exactly at r equals zero.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems it could have intersected r equals zero either before the singularity or after. If you put it this way, there's a point, there is a time, if this is a Penrose diagram, some time coordinate is going upward, there's a time at which the singularity intersects the axis at r equals zero. There's a time when the shell intersects the axis at r equals zero, and there are solutions. Your procedure should generate solutions for all those cases.
Mm-hmm.
And you're showing us a case where those two times coincide.
Yeah. Okay.
You just shift basically all the color part of it down.
All the colors down.
So would anything change in your picture? Or not, that's what I'm asking basically.
I don't see what you have in mind. Because
if the bounce happens before r equals zero, but r equal finite value bigger than zero. So which means you shift everything basically a bit lower. Would anything change or?
But I don't see how this is possible. You would like this line to be down?
No, the one on top. Lower.
Ah, the one on.
Yeah.
So the question is if the shell does not get to zero, it bounces before.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. If anything changes in this picture or not.
Probably nothing. So if you keep the same picture, but you move the r equals zero axis a little bit to the left, that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Probably nothing. You just have a little bit of Minkowski inside. Right? It's just Minkowski.
Well, yeah. Apart from what would happen in this region, we would still have the same procedure to guess what the mass has to be in the future, because we'd still have null shells of matter which are crossing. They are just not crossing at the same moment.
Okay, so that relation will still be valid.
Yeah. Okay. No more questions, I go. So, concretely, it's also very difficult to solve and get the true value of the mass and the true value of the radius everywhere on the diagram. But we can still prove something about the mass and tell something. And this is the theorem that we've proven. It's a theorem about the value of the mass mu, and it says that mu, the mass on the other side of the shell, is increasing in outgoing direction and is decreasing in ingoing direction. As a consequence, also we can say that the mass will be bounded between zero, which is good news. We will not have Schwarzschild with a negative mass, and the mass M1, which is the small mass, which is here depicted in blue, which is assumed to be Planckian. In other words...
And so you're saying this is, but independently of what is your model for R0, because you have, at each quantum, you have to choose the value of R0.
Yes, this theorem is independent on what's the modelization, the precise...
You assume that R0 decrease or increase? Or...
This we do. These are the above assumptions.
You
so we are assuming that here we are indeed in a white hole, which is a trapped region. So the radius is increasing in both null directions. And we are assuming that in here we are out of the white holes. And so the radius is decreasing in ingoing directions, but is decreasing in ingoing and increasing in outgoing. These are the two assumptions we have to make on the function for the radius to prove this theorem. But we do not need a specific model for it. Good. So what we get is that after the shell, we have a mass, a value for this mass, which is always positive, and which is also always very small. Smaller than M1, which is supposed to be Planckian. So physically, what's happening in this model is that after the bounce, just after the bounce here, the shell has still a very high energy. Its energy is given by the M, the big mass. But then, when the Hawking quanta are going to hit and to cross this shell, the Hawking quanta, they carry, inside the black hole, they carry a negative energy. And there will be an energy transfer between the negative energy of the Hawking quanta and the very large positive energy of the bouncing shell. And this energy transfer, which is tuned by this formula by Dreyer and Tooft, will end up in the fact that the bouncing shell will lose progressively its energy and will in the end become very small. At the end, the energy of the bouncing shell is Planckian. And at the same time, the Hawking quanta, which are crossing the shell, they gain energy and their energy is becoming positive. So this is one unexpected result that we get with this model, or surprising, is that for an observer, which is on Scribe Plus, this is the graph of the Bondi-Zach's mass that he will observe. So at the beginning, there is nothing very surprising. We have a big mass, which is slowly decreasing. Then it reaches a small Planckian mass. But the big question that we had was, what's happening next? What's happening when the quanta have crossed the singularity, have crossed the shell, and now are reaching Scribe Plus? What's happening? It was not obvious, because as I said, when they are created, the Hawking quanta inside the black hole, they carry negative energy. And so we could have said, think that this negative energy, is going to come out, and it's good that the Hawking quanta come out, because that would, for instance, solve the information loss paradox. But if they just come out, they will bring negative energy to Scribe Plus. And this would evidently be a violation of energy conditions. But what we observe is that no. Due to the interaction between the Hawking quanta and the bouncing shell, the Hawking quanta, which are arriving finally on Scribe Plus, they carry a positive energy. And what we observe is just that this Planckian size object is going to decay and its mass is going to zero smoothly. So this is the fourth point I wanted to make. Fifth point, let's talk about this
diamond
purple region. Here, this is where the metric violates Einstein equations. Or put it another way, the Penrose diagram is well defined everywhere around this metric, but here, there is a hole in the definition of the metric, which we have not made precise. So this kind of quantum region already existed in previous models. But in the previous models which were proposed, this region where the Einstein equations are violated was very big. Well, it is expected that we have such a region where Einstein equations are violated, because the black to white hole transition is not allowed by general relativity. So we cannot have a fully classical metric that describes it. But what's nice here is that the region where we have this violation has been made very, very small, since here the radius goes like that. So this is the radius along the singularity. In our model, I said it's a true singularity, so it's zero, the radius. But if we wanted to smooth it out, we expect that the radius should go as the mass along the singularity to the power 1/3. And along the apparent horizon, the radius goes as 2 times the mass. So if we if this region is, we can say that this radius, first, when we smooth out the singularity, can be very big. If I have a macroscopic black hole, this region where quantum effects are supposed to smooth out the singularity can be still very big. And when the black hole is evaporating, this region is becoming smaller and smaller. If you want, in other terms, this radius corresponds to the surface of the Planck star, which is behind the horizon. But with evaporation, the surface of the Planck star is going to decrease, but the position of the horizon is going to decrease even faster. And so there will be a moment where the horizon will reach the surface of the Planck star. This will happen when this radius will be equal to this radius, when here we only have one point instead of a diamond. And this is happening when the mass is Planckian. So the model we have can be chosen so that this region is Planckian. 6 points. 6 points in this model, we have a white hole which is stable. And that's important. Because remember, one reason people stopped looking at white holes is because they were believed to be unstable. And that's true for macroscopic white holes. Macroscopic white holes are unstable. But what if you have Planckian white holes? If you have Planckian white holes, then the usual argument to show the instability does not work anymore. Because this argument was saying we are looking at perturbations very long time ago in the past, and this perturbation would make the white hole to recollapse. But if the white hole is so small that it's Planckian, we don't have such trans-Planckian perturbation. So if we do not allow trans-Planckian perturbation, then we get objects which are stable white holes. Final point, we have a long-lived remnant. So why long-lived? Well, in this model, we can tune some parameters. One parameter that can be tuned according to what we expect is the lifetime of the black hole. We expect the lifetime of the black hole to be of the order of m to the cube, which is the characteristic time of Hawking evaporation. But then we can also tune the white hole lifetime to be proportional to m to the fourth. Why this? Because this is the estimation of the time required to purify Hawking evaporation. The reason it's bigger is because the white hole is very small. It has a very small mouth. And so it will need time for information which was inside the white hole to go out. The idea of long-lived remnants is also an old idea which had been abandoned for some reasons. At the beginning of the 80s, when people were talking about the information loss paradox, they had basically two choices. This is the vintage version of information loss paradox. They were saying, well, either the information is indeed lost, there is no possible unitary evolution between two Cauchy surfaces before and after the singularity. But another possibility was called long-lived remnants, or also Planck mass stable particles, also some with some variants, cornucopians. So the idea was that the black hole was evaporating until a certain point where the black hole is very small and actually would constitute like a particle, a Planck mass particle. But people abandoned this idea of long-lived particles, mainly for two reasons. So this is one of the ideas for what a long-lived remnant would be. It's it has a very small mouse, very small area, but inside we have a very long, large curvature, which also means that we have a very large volume. But people said, well, those objects are too small to account for the black Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Because if the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, well, it's proportional to the area. If I have a very small object, this area will be very small. And if the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy counts the number of degrees of freedom, it should account for all the entanglement between the Hawking quanta which are outside the black hole and the one which fell outside. This is Page's formulation of the information loss paradox. It says, well, it's based on the assumption that we are identifying Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and entanglement entropy between Hawking quanta. The entanglement entropy between Hawking quanta is supposed to increase as the evaporation goes on, because more and more correlations between inside and outside. But the Hawking Bekenstein, the entropy of Bekenstein-Hawking, it's supposed to decrease because the area is decreasing. And so in Page's formulation of the paradox, there comes a moment where the two curves crosses and the black hole is too small to account for all the entanglement between in and out. So that was a reason, but it's based on an assumption. And the assumption is this identification of this interpretation of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It says Bekenstein-Hawking entropy only account for all the degrees of freedoms of the black holes. But we can also have different interpretation. The interpretation of it is not clear. And if we stand on the idea that Bekenstein-Hawking entropy only counts the degrees of freedom of the surface, then it's fine. Because if we take into account all the degrees of freedom of the interior of the remnant, then there's a lot of space. The volume is very big. So there's a lot of space to put the correlations between the Hawking quanta inside and outside. So this argument can be argued against quite reasonably. Another argument, which was made by Suskin, was to say, well, is to say remnants will be infinitely favorable state because many different states can lead to the same remnant, which means that in the phase space, there will be a huge volume of remnants, and that would give a factor in the production rate in the amplitude, which would be very big. And so he says, we should see remnants, Planck mass stable particles produced in all the accelerators, but this is not seen, so they cannot exist. Well, this argument again is kind of weak and can be argued against. One reason for this is that the remnants might not be so favorable state, especially in this scenario where it's not so easy to create a remnant. We first have we first need a big black hole which evaporates during a long time, and then we are expecting a transition amplitude. And so there is a high threshold to create such remnants. So the overall scenario with all these characteristics, let me check time. Okay. This whole scenario, this characteristic, is kind of reviving two ideas which had been abandoned before, the idea of white holes and the idea of long-lived remnants. And put together, it seems to create something consistent. So this was a first model of evaporating black to white hole. Actually, we've considered another model. I will not go into too much details for the second model because I'm starting to run a bit out of time. The idea basically in the second model that we've proposed was that the Hawking particles inside the black hole could be scattered by the gravitational field, and they would reach, in this case, the singularity with an outgoing direction instead of an ingoing direction. And if this is the case, then we get this model. And this model is very different from the point of view of an observer at infinity, since in this case, there is a huge amount of negative energy which is observed. Here we have negative energy because the mass, the body mass, is increasing. This violates enormously energy conditions. Well, we can violate energy conditions to some extent. It is expected, since we have Hawking particles, but we cannot violate them too much. This is quantified by some inequalities, Flanagan inequalities. Let's move now to what we are now doing. What I've presented before is already published. Now, what I'm presenting now is some work which are currently in progress. So the idea is to study this quantum region. This quantum region is very small, it's Planckian. And we would like to apply covariant loop quantum gravity to it to compute its amplitude and to see the probability of such transition. So this is the standard procedure of a covariant loop quantum gravity. First, we need to describe correctly the geometry of a surface. So we choose a surface, space-like surface, which surrounds the quantum region. And this surface, we can describe it by an intrinsic metric, an extrinsic metric. Then this surface is triangulated. So this is the triangulation of only half of the surface, top or down. Then once we have this triangulation, we can associate to it the dual network and build a spin network. Then we have some requirements to choose the area and the external angles on the spin network to describe the most faithfully the geometry of the boundary. And when we have this spin network, we have to find a spin foam inside whose boundary is given by the spin network. And then we have formulas to compute the amplitude associated to this spin foam. Finally, this amplitude has to be interpreted. It has to be interpreted in terms of probability. And there comes the general boundary formalism of Eukel, which is very interesting in the sense that it gives some physical meaning to the amplitude in a covariant framework, since in a covariant framework we don't have clearly in and out state with no preferred time. That's not possible to do. So what we have instead is just an amplitude associated to a space-like surface. But then how do we interpret it? And the work of and in the framework of general boundary formalism, we can interpret the amplitude associated to a surface in terms of transition between two state of knowledge, which refer to a time proper to the observer. And finally, seven stepped, which is probably far in the future, we have to compare it to experiment. So, as a conclusion, Well, what I've presented to you mostly was this model, which is consistent, mathematically well-defined, and which provides the precise description of a scenario where we have a black hole which first evaporates and then turns into a white hole. Then a lot remains to be done, precisely the computation of the transition rate. And so the overall message, I would say, is a message of hope, because if you fall into a black hole, then you should, you may have a chance to escape. And this is a message of hope I wanted to tell you. Thank you for your attention. Sorry?
Only as Planckian quanta.
Yes, only as Planckian quanta. If you are macroscopic, probably you will get burnt by this Hawking quanta before you can go to the white hole region.
That's not such good news.
Are there questions from here? So we have plenty of time.
Thanks for this interesting talk. One question I ask is, it seems your talk has two parts. First part is to present a general setup for space-time without mentioning like quantum formalism. But then you modulate it a bit to calculate this using spin forms.
Yes.
So my question is, do you know if spin form is the most suitable tool for this kind of calculation?
So what else would you like to use, for instance? Do you have another idea?
Other approaches.
I mean, maybe. I don't know this formalism, so I will not be the one to use it to do the computation, but maybe that's doable, yeah. Interesting, sure.
If you send this quantum region to the size of this quantum region to zero, then you are probably left with some two sphere at that. So this quantum region shrinks to a corner, or something like that. Is the resulting geometry then smooth, or is there some curvature defect?
No, there is a defect. If you send this region to this quantum region to zero, then you don't get a smooth singularity. Otherwise, we would have done this. We get a defect, the various patches of the geometry around cannot be glued on this point consistently. There has to be a small space to breathe.
Can you say
that
the astrophysical signature?
There are ideas. An idea is that white holes could be candidate for dark matter. I don't know much how far this idea can be worked with. Maybe Carlo would add more to say about estimation of the number of white holes that we would need in the galaxy to explain all the dark matter that we observe. But surely that could be a candidate for the reason that white holes are very tiny particles, like Planckian, and they only interact gravitationally. But they still have a very small mass also, so I don't know quantitatively if this can account for all the dark matter or not. I think there was a sorry. I don't want to interrupt him, but
is that possible to, since you already have the full metric, is that possible to compute the asymptotic symmetry charge at the scribe so that it can impose a constraint on this quantum region of your amplitude?
Yeah, I guess it's doable because the metric is well defined everywhere, so it would be theoretically possible to compute this asymptotic charge. Yeah, but I have not done it. But
also, how difficult to analyze the complexity in this purple region? The complexity
The
complexity of this purple.
You're talking of the purple region?
Yeah.
And what do you mean by complexity?
The complexity, like, of a spin network state growing with time.
How do spin networks evolve in time?
Yeah, yeah, in this region. Like, is there, can it be associated with a notion of complexity?
But I don't see what is the complexity you're referring to. Is there? So first of all, in this model, this pink region is a hole. That is to say, we are not giving any prescription for the metric inside. It's a hole in my Penrose diagram, even though it's pink. So what the only thing I can describe is the geometry around the region. And this is what we are doing here. What we are describing is a space-like surface which is closed around this pink region. And this is a classical geometry which we can describe. It solves an Einstein equation. It can be described by just a usual differential geometry. And then we are looking for a spin network which will approximate this geometry correctly by putting some, you choosing some coherent states which will approximate the classical geometry, both intrinsically and extrinsically for the metric.
So you have like spin network on the boundary of this
yes.
And then.
Yeah, that's it.
But is the question how complex is the spin forming between?
Mm-hmm. You mean how many vertices, how many faces can I have? This inside, so the spin foam inside a priori, we can. There are many choices. This is the graph, the spin network that we have for only half of the surface. This spin network describes the geometry only of the upper part of the surface, and there is a similar one, exactly the same one, for the lower part, and both are connected by this external link. So this is a spin network, which is the minimal spin network we have been able to build. But still, it's already quite complex. Because you see, it has many nodes. It's coming from a triangulation, which was made with 24 tetrahedron. So this region, red surface, is first triangulated with 24 tetrahedra, then we take the dual, we construct the spin networks. So surely now, if we want to build the spin foams whose boundary is given by this spin network, it's going to be quite complex. There will be many vertices inside, many faces, and so you may ask reasonably, if it's so complex, how do you expect to do the computation correctly? Our expectation is that we will be able to do the computation anyway, because of symmetries. Although there are many, it's quite complex in terms of numbers of faces and numbers of vertices, there are a lot of symmetries. And these symmetries may be useful to do the computation.
Can you use the same graph for different boundary data? If you choose different data for your coherent state,
yes.
Can you write an amplitude which for different boundary data, and because how do you compute probability if you just compute one transition?
If you just
fix both the geometry, final geometry and the initial one, or just the final.
Yes.
How do you compute probability?
So this is using the general boundary formalism. So in the general boundary formalism, you associate an amplitude to any surface. You take a 3D surface in your space-time, you associate to it an amplitude. And as in this amplitude, the way you can interpret it as a probability is by saying, OK, this surface can be described by a certain state. And this state, I can have partial knowledge of it. If I acquire some knowledge, I will make a measurement on this surface, And by doing a measurement, I will update my knowledge on upon this surface. And so the probability that I compute is the probability between the first state of knowledge and the second state of knowledge. I'm not sure I'm very clear. Maybe if writing equations would be
I'm asking
easier.
Do you need different final state to compute probability, or it's enough to have just one final state to compute the probability? I mean, how do you normalize your probability if you don't have more final states?
Well, if you, what we will get, is not the, is truncated. It's not the complete result that we will get. It is true that if we want to get the complete probability, what we are looking for, we should consider not only this spin network and one spin form associated to it, but several spin networks that describe the geometry and several spin forms described inside.
But could you just keep the same spin network and give it different boundary data?
There's some parameters on which this geometry depends.
Yeah.
And so the amplitude depends on these parameters.
Yes.
And then you can compare.
So you can consider different final states.
Yeah, in that sense, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can say it corresponds to different parameters. For instance, you can compute that for as large as mass or smaller mass. The third order radius.
Okay.
So you say what is the probability for that relative to the other.
So somehow all the physics, the interesting physics, which is how big the outgoing mass is or how fast it will come out, depends on what happens in this tiny region.
Of course, if you assume that along the singularity, the other kind of quantum calculation, leave those ones. Those ones just say that you go over with the same.
Yeah, it's a continuity condition.
Right. So that would determine the lifetime.
Well, that's actually
a transition.
Black and white. Other question? Yeah, I've had more questions to ask afterwards, but it's a follow up to this. So you also have a second model.
Yes.
Model 2, where you have
negative
energy coming out. So I suppose if you just consider the global region, not just this small red boundary, but the global region,
yes.
I suppose. In a path integral, you would have these two models, all like every other model contributes.
Yeah, that's true. But the region, the local region of the geometry near the quantum region is the same in both cases. In these cases, locally, around the quantum region, the geometry is the same. So what we expect is that physically, if this is possible, both models should play a role. The reason is that the motivation for doing a second model is because when we are looking inside the black hole and when we are computing the stress energy tensor, we see that we have contributions which diverge on the singularity when r goes to zero. But more importantly for us, we have contributions which are equal in all directions. So when we are approaching the singularity, we have quantas which are going ingoing, but we have the same amount of quanta which are outgoing. That was the motivation for considering this. But we expect that what would happen physically is in between. Some quanta would go in, some quanta would go out. Here we have the two extreme cases. For doing the computation of the amplitude, that's another thing, because the geometry around the quantum region does not is the same in both cases.
If there's more time, I have another question. There's one before I speak.
Yeah, because I would like to ask a question as well. So you gave us a little bit your interpretation of like black hole entropy and what it's supposed to be. Did you try to compute like entropy in your model? And do you necessarily need to know what happens inside the quantum region to compute it?
Um, So to the second question, no. You don't need to. So the way, it depends what kind of entropy you want to compute. You're asking me, maybe, can I compute the entanglement entropy on Scry plus the...
Well, naturally, people will be interested about asking about the black hole information paradox, whether you can provide a solution for that. You basically just gave heuristic arguments, so I'm just wondering, can you back this up with a calculation?
Yeah, so here we don't have... Okay. Yeah, here we don't have any computation to motivate the fact that information loss paradox is solved. Just have this idea that I have Hawking quanta, which went out at some point, and we can recover them on Scry plus. So if they were carrying correlations when they were formed along the apparent horizon, then it's very natural to believe that this information will be recovered on Scry plus then. Now I see that there is a computation which could be made, which is the computation of the entanglement entropy on Scry plus, which was done, for instance, by Bianchi in other cases. And we have computed it also, but not for this model. For a simpler model, we have a formula. The idea is to compute what's called the ray tracing map. So how the coordinates on Scry minus relate to the coordinates on Scry plus. And these relations between the coordinates will depend on the metric inside. This ray tracing map, we can compute it, but we've not done it. And then there is a direct formula which enables you to compute the entanglement entropy on Scry plus if you have the ray tracing map. So this could be a computation to do. We've not done it because it's a bit tricky, and that was not our goal.
One last question.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's the point of like, what does crossing the singularity, what happens to that?
Where?
So, that when the.
Here?
Now I'm crossing the singularity.
In this model. So, maybe we should zoom a bit, but, well, here, at the level of the apparent horizon, here, we have particles which are created. Outside, they are outgoing. Inside, they are ingoing. And then we have proposed a very rough modelization for the scattering of the quanta inside. Inside the black hole, at the beginning, the quanta are ingoing. And here, we have put a boundary, which is a bit arbitrary. And after this boundary, the Hawking quanta are now outgoing. It's a rough way to modelize the scattering, the fact that the quanta are changing directions. And so when they reach the singularity, those quanta are ingoing. And the prescriptions to go beyond is the same as before, is that we just continue the particles along geodesics in the same direction. And in this case, it's even simpler than in the first case, because they just go out in outgoing direction, and then they reach Scry plus. There is no crossing between the bouncing shell and the Hawking quanta as before. It's even simpler. Yeah?
Maybe last question.
Just because I'm now looking at this graph, is there some sort of Heisenberg uncertainty relation to be satisfied for delta m times delta u in order h bar?
Yeah. That's Flanagan inequality. It's to say that we can violate energy conditions, but not too much. So we can maintain a violation during a certain amount of time, but we can have a very small violation during very long, or a very large during a short time. Well, we have constraints on that. That's why this model here is not, we know it's not physical at all, this profile of Bondi mass, because we have a long violation, a large violation during a very long time.
Okay.
So this model completely violates the Flanagan inequalities. But the first model, no. So.
Okay. Yeah, let's close the seminar here.
Thank you.